Hello, welcome to Converging Dialogues. This is Xavier Bonilla. In this episode, I'm very happy to bring the conversation I have with Clay Rutledge. Clay is an existential psychologist, writer, and consultant. He is vice president of research and director of the Human Flourishing Lab at Archbridge Institute. He has published more than 100 academic papers, co-edited 3 books, authored 3 books, and received numerous awards for scholarly research and student mentorship. And he is the author of the most recent book, Past Forward, How Nostalgia Can Help You Live a More Meaningful Life. And that's what we talk about in the conversation. We start by talking about how we define nostalgia, what it means, what it is, what it isn't. Nostalgia being forward thinking, which sounds kind of counterintuitive, but Clay's got a really nice way of conceptualizing and thinking about it. Nostalgia with positive and negative memories, and the downsides of nostalgia in pop culture. This is a fun conversation, and on this bit of it with pop culture, we spend a good amount of time there. Obviously, we make plenty of pop references and stuff, but I push back a little bit on this because I think that nostalgia has definitely some negative aspects, and I don't think Clay disagrees with that, but we have a really nice exchange, and again, kind of pulling at this concept with nostalgia and what it looks like. And he was just so gracious and so wonderful in this bit of the conversation. And it really is just a conversation. It really feels that way. And he's absolutely wonderful. So I really, really enjoyed that part of it. We also talk about nostalgia with self-concept, self-continuity, and self-esteem. Again, here I give a little pushback, self-esteem and what it is in the literature and what we know it's not now. And again, he was super generous with his ideas and really gracious with how he accepted some of my pushback. So he was just really, really lovely. We talk about nostalgia for understanding existential anxiety and death, best ways to use nostalgia, and many more topics. I can't say enough good things about this conversation and about Clay himself. He's really a wonderful human being, super, super brilliant, really, really good thinker. And I really, really enjoyed this conversation. He's somebody I wish I could talk to more often on the podcast, get him here once a month. He was just really, really wonderful. I really enjoyed this conversation. As always, you can find this conversation and all other conversations at convergingdialogues.substack.com. I'm also on YouTube. Get over there, subscribe, like, follow, tell your friends, check out some of the other episodes I've done, see what other topics you may find interesting. And continue listening to all the ones coming out. So now I bring you Clay Rutledge. I'm here with Clay Rutledge. Clay, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I'm looking forward to speaking with you.
Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. We were just talking before we started that we've been mutuals probably online for who knows how long, but both of us are becoming more and more offline, which is probably a good thing. And right. And so you've written a great book, which I greatly enjoyed. It's a really easy read, but also it's nice because there's obviously you can tell there's the research and a lot of like scientific studies in there, but just a really nice kind of digestible way of getting that. It's not too sciencey, which was really nice. And the book is called Past Forward, How Nostalgia Can Help You Live a More Meaningful Life. Great title, by the way. And so nostalgia is what we're going to be talking about. It's before we get into all that, tell listeners just kind of who you are professionally, academically, and some of the things you currently do.
Yeah. So I'm what's called an existential psychologist by training. I did my PhD in social psychology and with the like focus area on, what it is that makes humans a uniquely existential species, capable of asking big questions about the nature of our existence, the meaning of our lives, and how that influences our goals, our priorities, our well-being. And all of that. So I was a professor for many years, 17 years, in this psychology department, and then ultimately in a business school. And then more recently, I've left academia, and I am now the director of the Human Flourishing Lab at the Archbridge Institute, which is a nonpartisan think tank that studies both like the and sort of promotes both the kind of economic and social, cultural, psychological ingredients to human flourishing. So as a psychologist, I'm, you know, very much focused on the psychology side of things there. And what I'm really interested in is, you know, how to help people live more fulfilling, more meaningful lives in which they're able to reach their full potential and really flourish. And so I'm doing, you know, I'm doing a lot of the same stuff I did as a researcher in academia, but now more public facing, more geared towards, you know, directly interacting with the public as opposed to doing more like, you know, like scientific writing and academic journals and things like that. So it really makes me happy that you noted that the book was an easy read, because, you know, it seems like it would be easier to write an easy read book. But as someone who spent most of his career writing empirical journal articles and editing, you know, these types of scholarly books, I actually found it, you know, fairly difficult to do that. So that's something that, you know, that's something I'd be excited about in my sort of new career path, is really moving away from things for other scholars to read and trying to do more things for like regular people to read. So I appreciate that. You found it fairly accessible.
I haven't written a book yet. People have asked me if I'm writing one, and I'm not, but I'm not inspired, I guess, to write on any one thing in particular yet. I don't know. It'll come to me. But I have written a few pieces like for like a public audience, and it's just like, I don't know. Like, I feel like I don't know how to write in English when I do that. I'm just like, I don't know. I got a PhD. I wrote a dissertation. I wrote papers. I'm like published. But it's just like, nobody taught me how to write this way. I don't know how to write this way. Like, this is so foreign to me. I ask all my friends that, you know, do like creative writing or they you know, masters in writing. And it's just like, can you tell me how to write? I don't know how to do this. But you did a great job, though.
I think we write how we think. And so, like, if you think about things in really nuanced, complex ways, and you're really interested in understanding, like, evidence and big ideas and processes and, you know, all of those things, like, that tends to come out, I think, in the way you put, you know, pen to paper. So I think it is hard to be like, well, how do I talk about this? How do I put myself in someone else's head, right? Mm-hmm. And like talk about an idea or explain an idea. And it's not like an intellect thing. I think dumbing down isn't quite the right way of saying it. It's saying, no, not everyone's nerding out on this at the same level I am, but they are interested in getting some, you know, getting the basics from it. It's like, I go watch a movie on a topic that I'm somewhat interested in, like, you know, I want to, you know, I'm interested in this new Ferrari movie, but I don't want to read a Ferrari manual. I just want the high points of the story. And I think that's the trick, is like, how do most people, that's what they want from most subjects, is they just want to get the gist of it, and figuring out how to do that. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying I'm, you know, necessarily very good at it. Some people are very, very talented at that, but I think that's the trick.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. It's how do people kind of get it. I would imagine also that, you know, if you taught for a long time, teaching forces you to find, it's like, okay, you're explaining something to somebody, a student or whatever, and they're not getting it. So you have to like explain the same thing in like three different ways sometimes. And then it's, that's okay. Now it clicks. Yeah. Teaching kind of does that for you. So I just imagine writing's sort of similar.
That's a great point.
Of doing
So. No, that's a great point. There's nothing more humbling than the feedback from, you know, the students falling asleep or checking their phones or whatever, when you think you're like laying down some wisdom.
Like, you know, this is crushing right now. And then they're just kind of like spaced out. They're not even paying attention. Yeah, that's definitely something that happens. Okay, so nostalgia. You know, you talk about this, you're writing about this. I guess for me, nostalgia seems to be this kind of focus on the past, and you say that it's actually essential for progress and improvement, and that it's very forward thinking, actually. So maybe define for us, what is nostalgia, or what's a good operational definition, and why is it, you know, very helpful for us to be, you know, have progress and very forward thinking?
Yeah. So if you look online at like a dictionary, you'll see a definition that's like, nostalgia is a sentimental longing for the past or wistful longing for the past, which kind of gets at it. But that really emphasizes the affective or the more emotional component of nostalgia, that longing for, or even the desire, you know, the kind of motivational component of it. But when we think of nostalgia, it's also worth thinking about as the more like cognitive side of things. Like, it involves memories, right? And so we have this feeling, the sentiment, yes, but then that usually conjures up memories that we associate with that feeling. Like, we remember the good old days, as they say. And so I really think of nostalgia as like this combination, this cocktail of emotion and cognition, like our longing, like our desire, our wanting for particular, like to revisit particular memories. And these memories tend to be the memories that we find the most fulfilling or the most meaningful in our lives. Like, you can be nostalgic about lots of things, and you know, these memories can vary in how meaningful they are. But at the core of a lot of people's nostalgia is this sense of, I've moved through life and collected all these different types of experiences. Some of them are really special to me. They really made a mark. They really helped me figure out who I am, or they really revealed something about me, or they reminded me of why life's worth living. And we, you know, in those memories, we find particularly useful when we're trying to move forward with life. So another way to think about it is the past has already happened. The future's unknown, but we're a very future-oriented species, right? We have this capacity to think about the future, to imagine the future, which is very good for planning, for goals. It's very good for progress too. Like, you know, the reason we might care about like what society, what civilization is like for future generations is because we can imagine it. We can say, oh, maybe we would like them to have, you know, nice things or a better life than us. But there's also all sorts of uncertainty associated with that. We all know that anything can happen tomorrow, good and bad. And as much as we try to control that, we know that, you know, life can be chaotic and uncertain. And then even when we're making decisions, a lot of times we're not sure which direction in life to take. And so that uncertainty towards the future tends to make us look for some sort of both comfort, but also guidance. And so the past has already happened, so we can pull from the experiences that we found in some way, like soothing, but also that we think could be useful. So it's like, you might move to a new city and you might feel lonely. And I don't, you know, how am I going to meet people? Did I make a mistake? Like, you know, how am I going to go forward? And then, you know, you can reflect on positive social experiences you had in the past. And that, you know, does a couple of things. It pulls you out of the moment and allows you to be like, okay, this moment right now is not great, but it's just a moment. Life is bigger than this. I've had other moments, and some of those moments were very fulfilling. So it can help you take that perspective. But I think it can also provide you with very specific information about like, oh, like I've had to make new friends in the past. I've been in situations before where I didn't know anyone, and then I formed this lifelong friend. You know, for example, and that gives you like the confidence that you can succeed in your new endeavors. So in a lot of ways, I think that's how nostalgia work. We're in this constant relationship between the life we want to live, the direction we want to take, the uncertainty associated with that, but also needing some guidance. And where do you look for guidance? You look to the, you know, when it comes to your own autobiographical memories, you look to those special experiences that you think helped you become the person you are, that, or the person that you want to be.
Yeah, a lot of that tracks. I guess the one thing I'm curious is, do we, you know, we tend to have a trait negativity bias, right? And how much are we, you know, this sounds like a kind of double-edged sword, right? Like, we can, when it comes to recollecting various memories, that we can remember, or we can be nostalgic for positive and negative memories. So how much does nostalgia help in certain ways where it's like, yeah, I can remember a really positive time or a really positive experience, something that was really, you know, sentimental or, you know, whatever. But then I can also remember, like, you know, it could be a trauma, or it could be something really negative. It could be something related to heartbreak or loss, you know, things like that. How much does that also happen and maybe is less helpful for us if we're trying to, I guess you could see it from two perspectives. That could be less helpful in one sense and then actually really helpful in another sense. But this idea of negative and positive memories.
Yeah. So a couple of things. One, we have this, you know, what's sometimes referred to as the fading affect bias, where our memory tends to be biased towards negative experiences. The affective intensity of them tend to fade faster than positive experiences. So you can have something that, you know, you can have an experience in life that actually had, you know, a fair amount of negative affect in it, and you tend to forget, the intensity of that affect diminishes with time. It doesn't sting as much as time passes. So that's one thing to keep in mind. But the other thing is, nostalgia is actually this interesting like cocktail of, it's not purely positive memory. It's not just a happy memory. Oftentimes our nostalgic memories involved some kind of overcoming a difficulty, or like it was an adventure. We went on this road trip with friends, and it was disastrous in a lot of ways, but we became closer. And so I think one of the ways that nostalgia works is, as time passes, our brains, have time to sort of make sense, weave together like a coherent narrative. And we like to feel like there's some sort of lessons from something. And so immediately after something, if you had a family event or whatever, and you fought a lot, and then immediately after you're like, yeah, there were some high points, but you know, it was also really negative. Over time, when the emotion fades a little bit, you might be in a better position to be like, oh, like that, you know, I learned something from that. So I don't think it has to be a purely positive experience for it to be a candidate for a nostalgic memory. But a key is, it tends to be an experience that is what's oftentimes what's referred to as follows a redemptive, emotional arc. So there might be negative elements to it, but there was a positive conclusion. And so sometimes, loss can be powerful. We can have memories associated with loss that, make us sad, but also at the same time remind us of how meaningful that relationship was. And it's that, it's that the ending with gratitude or positivity or whatever that tends to push it into the nostalgia column. So, people can have, that's to say, we can have lots of different memories, including very, very traumatic and unpleasant ones that oftentimes are sources of pathology, right? They're not the types of things that people really want to revisit a lot. But nostalgic memories tend to, be different from that. And they tend to be like I said, even if they have negative elements, they tend to have some kind of lesson learned. When I was at the University of Southampton, when I first started some of the early years of doing this research, we actually collected a bunch of nostalgic narratives from older adults. Southampton was a city that nearly 90% of it was destroyed during World War II by German bombers because it was a port city. And so a lot of the people we were collecting narratives from at the time were children during that period. And they, surprising to us, because everything I'm saying to you right now is not what I hypothesized going into it. This was more of discovery than it was prediction. I wouldn't have expected that there would be so much nostalgia for these kind of traumatic time periods and experiences. But there was a lot of nostalgia for that time. And it wasn't because people thought it was great to be bombed, but for their city to be destroyed by a German bombing. It wasn't because they thought that it was great that they were separate, their fathers were all sent to the continent to fight, war. It was because they said, well, during that time of my life, we learned something about the importance of a family, or the kind of the nonsense of life was sort of shedded. And, these kinds of experience really focus you on what's most important in life. And so these kind of defining moments people often have nostalgia for, even if they're not, extremely positive.
It's very interesting, because at the end of the day, we have the past always kind of present with us, whether we're accessing it or we're not accessing it, which is very interesting. Now, I guess there's a few ideas here I want to connect, but sometimes I think that people can be too stuck. Well, two things. They can be too stuck in the past with this kind of view of nostalgia, but also they have, a lot of our memories are inaccurate and they're mm-hmm. they're fuzzy, and we remember things the way we want to remember them, not necessarily exactly how it happened, which right. you know, you could debate, you know, the importance of that. So there's that on the individual level, but I find that more recently, so this is a little bit kind of a branch off of the kind of central theme here, but you'll see where I'm going with it. I find that in our media, we have this almost this kind of, I don't know, pornography of nostalgia, right? Where it's everything is, you know, the good old days of how we used to do things, so much that I think a lot of the times we're creating a lot of content, but we're creating less art. We're creating less things of novelty. And I think of this when people say the types of music they like, the types of shows they watch, the types of films they watch, or, you know, things that are in kind of things that are popular or things that are make a lot of money or things like that. I mean, of course, there's always a kind of niche, you know, whatever. But when you think about things, whether it's, you know, even in pop culture, there's this fascination with wanting to have a sequel and have a sequel trilogy and then a prequel and a spinoff and it's just all of these things. And it's like, look, like, this was good. I don't know if I want another. I don't know if I want Top Gun 3. I mean, Top Gun 2 was great, but I mean, and the original was fine.
Is it going to be Top Gun 3?
Yeah, it was announced today that it's in the works, you know. you know, we're going to get an eighth Mission Impossible movie, which again, I mean, those movies are great. I don't dislike them. But I think about things like, you know, people want... I feel like sometimes nostalgia can be a kind of security blanket for people to prevent them from growing. So for example, like, this is just an example, but like, people love Friends. They love Friends. They love that show. People love The Office. They love that show. People quote it. People watch it 27,000 times. And that's fine. Like that, I mean, whatever. But a lot of the times, these things become, well, when can we have, like, you know, another season of this? Or it's almost like they don't want things to end, or they don't want to try new things, or, and I don't quite understand it. I find it, like, it can really prevent people from progressing forward. I think they kind of get stuck there sometimes. Like, I mean, last bit on this, right, is, I mean, we're still hearing, you know, Star Wars fans go on and on and on and on and on and on about the original trilogy. And don't get me wrong, original trilogy is great. Empire is the best film. We all know this. Like, that's fine. You know, but like, you know, people give me shit about this, but like, the prequel trilogy isn't terrible. I mean, there's picky things about it, but story-wise, I think it's pretty good. But, you know, when you watch, you know, Force Awakens, it's literally A New Hope for 2015 or whenever it came out. It's the same story. Yeah. It's the same thing. It's all this stuff. And I don't know. People just always, people complain about stuff. And it's like, well, why do you just want the same thing? Like, you have it. Yeah. Like, you're not going to capture that. And if you take an objective point on Star Wars, I mean, I know it's big in pop culture, but I mean, it's basically a shitty B movie. Like, it's not good. It's not... The writing's not good. The acting's not good. Oh, the effects aren't good.
I'm triggered.
You know what I mean? Like, and I'm the biggest Star Wars fan. I've seen all of those movies a million times, and I love it. And I know what it is, and I know what it isn't. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. Mm-hmm. But I just, people, they just don't want anything potentially off of that. They just want it to be what they want it to be when they saw it. And I can get some of this. Like, you know, you want to create a memory. You want to create how you felt when you were 15 and you saw it the first time and nothing quite gets that again or whatever. But do you think that there's, in general media or pop culture or for where we're at, that this kind of obsession or fascination of nostalgia can be, harmful is a little strong, but it can impede growth or creativity for new things?
So there's a, Okay, there's a lot of different. Yeah, I think I have a lot of different answers to that.
You like the original trilogy of Star Wars, though. That this is important.
I do.
Okay, that's good.
I do. I mean, I'm not like a. I wouldn't say I know people that have read the books, watched, you know, adults that have watched the cartoons. You know, I'm not at the like played all the games like. I've seen all the movies and I've watched, I think, most of the live action television series on Disney Plus. And I generally like, you know, I wasn't a big fan of the new three latest movies, but I won't nerd out too much on that, but I could articulate, I could articulate why in particular, but I, you know, we just watched, what's the most recent? We just watched the most recent show.
It'd be Ahsoka would be the most recent one.
Yeah, I liked it. But I'm not like, I'm just not that hardcore about that stuff. But you know, to answer your question, well, one answer is not okay. This isn't a direct answer, but I think it gets to like maybe helps explain why some of this is going on. So the irony of nostalgia and progress, and you know the concern you raise about like nostalgia as a barrier to like new ideas, creativity, innovation, those things is like when the world is actually changing a lot, that creates anxiety. You know, rapid change, and that tends to make people nostalgic. So in a way, it's, you know, it's almost as if, yeah, maybe we're not getting, maybe this isn't the best time for like Hollywood in terms of creativity, but there's other things going on in the world that are changing or causing a lot of like uncertainty and anxiety, whether it's political issues or the pandemic or, you know, the pace of, you know, digital technology change, internet, social media and stuff like that. And something, you know, because I get this question a lot, actually, from journalists. It's like, oh, are we in an age of nostalgia? Like, is this like all the stuff you said, you know, and then they'll list a bunch of like brands that are, you know, repackaging things to look like the old brand or bringing out old products and all these things. You know, so there's all these indicators that seems like nostalgia is like going nuts right now. Now, I don't know if that, I mean, I'm not saying that's not true, but it's not like I have good data of like how nostalgic were people 100 years ago or even 50 years ago. So it could be like in our area of like digital technology and online culture, like it's a lot easier to really generate a lot of and share a lot of nostalgic content. And, you know, maybe before television, people were like sharing the same stories over and over. You know, maybe there wasn't I don't know how to compare like how original content was before compared to now and how nostalgic people were. So that relationship, I'm totally sure. But what I do know from our research is when people feel like the world is changing a lot, particularly in ways that make them anxious, they tend, their interest in consuming nostalgia certainly goes up. And so it could be, you're right, that like, you know, like it could be like, production companies are like, wow, like the audiences really want, like the movies that are really doing well are these like sequels. And so we should, you know, just from an economic point of view, like we should fund those, like we should make those because that seems to be what the market demands. You know, that could certainly be true. But another point I'll make around that is those are like sort of the obvious examples of like prepackaged nostalgia. It's like, oh, we're going to release a new Star Wars. But if you take a deeper look at things that you actually find to be very, very creative or like, do you know, taking something in a new direction or very innovative, oftentimes there's they're nostalgic too, or there's a very much more subtle and well utilized form of nostalgia. So a lot of musicians will talk of like even very like, even musicians that we think are doing something really fresh, they'll, you know, they have their nostalgic memories for what got them into that music and they want to pay tribute. You know, they'll work in a little hook or they'll work in something that's like, this is a nod to this person who influenced me. And that's probably been the case throughout the history of art, right? Throughout the history of culture is I'm taking something that really inspired me when I was young, and I'm making it more relevant, more fresh, you know, trying to take it in a new direction. So that fusion of like tradition with innovation, I think is where nostalgia is kind of at its best. But I share your like criticisms of a lot of like the content we see. That really just seems like it's you know, it's just like it's a very simplistic nostalgia. It's like, oh, people just want like, you know, people just want another Star Wars movie, and then they want to complain about it because it wasn't as good or whatever. That's, you know, I've done some consulting work with companies on nostalgia, you know, and one of the things I say is it's like nostalgia can be a very, very powerful tool. But it's a dangerous one too, because you have to get it right. Because like if you anger the diehards, like we were talking about the Star Wars people, it's very, very, people who are the hardcore fans are very, very hard to please. So it's like when you activate, nostalgia can really bring them out for sure. But then you're dealing with something sacred. Like you have to do it right.
You kind of are, because that's your memory. Like people not only have their like memory, but they have their like memory in time. So this was the thing I was gonna mention. I remember people were very into Stranger Things, this show on Netflix. You know, a lot of people would talk about it and be like, do you like it or whatever? And I'm always the kind of like older person that's kind of grumpy now. And I'm just kind of like, yeah, it's fine. I mean, is it really that good? I mean, it's just this, I don't know. I think it's like the third or fourth season. I think it was the third season where it was just like legitimately 80s throwback season. And I just wasn't into it. It just was very like cheap and not creative. And it was like, I don't need this. Like, I don't.
Did you like The Americans?
I did like The Americans, but I liked The Americans in a way in which it was kind of like Mad Men. It's almost like a kind of historical narrative of sorts, where it's like, you know, very, it's not like trying to be like, I don't know, like in Stranger Things, it was like, let's go like rollerblading and we're going to listen to, you know, A Flock of Seagulls, One Hit Wonder and Western, you know, whatever. It's not like that kind of, you know, very obvious on the nose. With those kinds of shows, it was more of like, no, we're literally telling a story in this time. And in this time, you know, with a kind of realism of sorts. So I kind of like, my mind shifts a little bit. And I guess, I don't know, maybe it's because it's like a serious drama or things like that. But I think there are some cheap things there. It's like, you know, like Metallica still keeps putting an album out every 5 or 6 years. And like, I still think Metallica is still the biggest metal band ever. But it just doesn't, it's just them trying to do Master of Puppets and the Black Album over and over and over again. It's just like, you guys did it and it's great. And those albums are great. Don't keep trying to make that album anymore. But I think it's because there's a kind of monetization of that. Right? Like people like that stuff. And when you see new bands or other things that try to rip off of them or other people before them, it's like, you're right. Everyone's influence, or there's a nod to this. That's cool. But I think when it clearly sounds like this is a ripoff of, you know, fill in the blank, I don't think we should. I think when it's like, when you're incentivized to do it, whether with status or with popularity or with money, I don't think that's helpful, because that's just really pushing something that feels kind of stuck. And I think there's a lot of films and shows and music that does that. And it's like, no, maybe we don't reward. I mean, I'm going to get a lot of heat for this maybe, but like, except for like the diehards out there, like I don't need another Marvel film. I don't need, we've had 32 of those films or whatever. I don't need another one. Like I just, it's fine. Like, it's fine. Like,
well, they're starting to not do well now. Right.
Yeah. Because it's old. It's just, they're not really,
well, that's where I think, you know, And so that's what my next answer to you know, I said it's complicated. My next answer is going to really lean into like personality, which is, I mean, you're speaking from your perspective with your, you know, with your personality, and you nailed it. You said a lot of people are into this. So, you know, one of the things, you know, I get into a little bit in the book, not too deeply, but towards the end when I'm talking about like the progress stuff, and people just vary in how much, how comfortable they are with change.
Yeah.
And some people really are, you know, and you might just be on, you know, on that side of the continuum that's like, I'm fine with nostalgia, but it's got to be pretty subtle because I prefer the balance to be towards like doing something really creative and new. Mm. But a lot of people aren't, you know, that way, you know, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people are somewhere in the middle, but there are people on like the extreme other side where they're extremely nostalgic and they really are very conservative. And I don't mean politically, I mean like conservative in their approach to living. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They like their patterns. Mm-hmm. they, I've interacted, you know, doing some of this work, I've interacted with a lot of people who are, not all collectors are this way, but you know, there are people that their hobbies, their interests are such where they really like things to be a particular way. Mm. And, you know, that's what brings them happiness, right? That, you know, they don't want a lot of change. Mm-hmm, and, you know, so, and then I think, you know, and then, like I said, on the other end, of, there's the people that are really, really on the bleeding edge of like, they are easily bored by anything that seems slightly repetitive. Mm-hmm. Most people aren't that way either. Most of us are somewhere in the middle. Mm. And finding, that's why, I mean, I think it's hard for like companies can pull the nostalgia lever, but can also, and definitely make some money, clearly. It's a very powerful marketing tool. But it's a popular aesthetic preference. And it's a cyclical thing too. Like it's not, you know, we're talking about movies and music, but like, if you look at a lot of fashions, if you look at a lot of architectural styles, if you, you know, just the way things look, people's aesthetic preferences, they tend to be, one way you're thinking about it is like, people, I don't know how old you are, but I'm 47. People my age, you know, middle age is when people start to get to the positions in organizations in which they get to call the shots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you get this thing or it's like, oh, this is the stuff I'm, you know, this is the stuff I grew up with. Mm-hmm. And maybe if you're good, if you're creative, if you're clever, hopefully you're going to do something fresh with it. But often you get this nod to like, well, this is the things, these are the things that influenced me. You definitely, you know, as we pointed out, you definitely see this in film. I mean, and some people really, it's just, it's very, very, it's not subtle at all. Like J.J. Abrams, like start, you know, when he did Star Wars, right? It's like, clearly, like you could see his love for a particular, for a particular type of movie. Mm. He put his own stamp on it, but it's like you can see, like okay, like he's at the age where he's getting to be the creator of this content, and you see this kind of happen a lot, in terms of these cycles. But where I would say that, I know you didn't say, you kind of held back from saying harmful. I think most of the time that sort of nostalgia is harmless in the sense that honestly, a lot of entertainment content is not great. Like we all have our guilty pleasures or whatever, but it's funny because it's like, we have this, like you were talking about bias. Like we have this bias. It's like people will think that, oh man, music used to be really good. And now like everything I listen to is garbage. But if you actually go back and like, so I listened to a lot of alternative music in the 90s, that was my scene. There was a lot of crappy music back then. we've just pulled out the greats. Like and that's kind of how this, like we've pulled out the things that we really liked that we thought were good. And you forget that at that time, there was a lot of music that was like, oh, like Pearl Jam already did that. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't need another one of these or whatever. So I think that's a permanent, that's a permanent state of the human condition. Like there's a good portion of entertainment content that's just not that original. It's just not that creative. Mm. But I do think you're right that there's something about, you know, and some of it might be like nostalgia intersects with these weird things like finance in the sense that like movie, like the Marvel movie is a good example. And you hear about how studios don't want to take risks, because they spend $200 million on a movie. Like a lot of times I watch a movie and I'll see something I really like and come to find out that was like a $20 or $30 million. Like that still seems like a lot of money, but it's like they were more willing to like try something new with a lower budget. Mm-hmm. I kind of wish they would just, they would make more. I like a lot of sci-fi action stuff. I kind of wish they would just make more like lower budget, more creative movies instead of being like, every movie has to be a $200 a $200 million production. Because when they do that, yeah, they're very, very, they become very risk averse. And, you know, they lean heavily on what worked in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think I saw, you know, one movie that comes to mind is, you know, Beau Is Afraid by Ari Aster that had Joaquin Phoenix. And I loved that film. I thought it was great. And it didn't do very well because it's a weird fucking movie. I mean, it's a weird movie. Like, and it's 3 hours. And it's just like, yeah, I get why people didn't like it. But I think it was well done. I think it was great. But I think you're right. I think it does go to people's preferences. And I think that... it's a kind of like back and forth with this, right? With media of like, what are, you know, labels or studios or whatever. There's an influence they have on like the population, but then there's also like what the population likes and influences right. them. There's like this kind of weird reciprocal kind of thing that happens. And like, you know, I mean, I'm pretty sure a lot of people watched Oppenheimer because it was the whole Barbie Oppenheimer thing last summer, right? Mm, I mean, like most people would not go and watch that movie if it wasn't whatever the thing that created out of whatever. Right. And vice versa. People that were seeing Oppenheimer were probably not going to go see Barbie, but you know, both films did well and both people are happy and whatever. But sometimes that happens, right? And I think it's just like, oh, you know, because the fifth Indiana Jones movie did not do well, right? I mean, it did That's okay, right. but it was like, it's like another thing where it's just like, okay, like I don't want to see 80-year-old Harrison Ford trying to do stuff he did like in Temple of Doom. Like it just doesn't work. Yeah. It doesn't, I mean, I didn't mind the film. Everyone that I knew hated it, but I actually didn't mind it. But you could see what was there and it was, I don't know, I thought it was better than the fourth one. But you know what I mean? Like it's just stuff like that. It's like, yeah, we don't need to have a spin-off or, you know, whatever. You know, it's just, I don't know. There's certain things that, you know, we can have it there. But I think you're right that it is, at the end of the day, when I have these conversations, I get this to this point in the conversation, I'm always left unfulfilled. But it is a kind of like, yeah, everyone's different and everyone likes different things. And I was just, and I totally agree with that. Like, it's a totally real thing.
Yeah.
My question is though, it's like, why is like so many people have that kind of, I don't want to say personality, but enough to like something to make it popular or whatever, if it's feeding on a nostalgic thing. And you know, I think it's a hard question to answer. You never know what can be kind of, you know, take off or things like that. But it is interesting.
Well, it's hard to go from the, you know, because I'm just like winging it here as far as a media critic. Like, you know, it's hard to go from the, you know, the like psychological science on nostalgia, which is more about like what happens when people revisit personally cherished memories themselves and how that influences their cognition, motivation, and behavior. And then obviously like connect that to this, you know, multidimensional idea of like an entertainment experience, which is driven by a lot of different variables. The Indiana Jones thing was, you know, that was a great example because sometimes, you know, sometimes nostalgia flops. I mean, sometimes sometimes the nostalgia, like I said, the nostalgia that works is often people don't even detect that it was nostalgic to begin with. You know, an example I think of is the John Wick franchise, which is, you know, there's, of course, now there's like four movies. So it's not like it's a new thing in itself, but they've all been very successful, I believe. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of mixing of nostalgia in there of like, you know, comic book, anime, you know, old school kind of action movies, martial arts movies. There's all this stuff, but it's done in a way. And this is, again, this is where I think nostalgia is at its best. It's done in a way where it's like, okay, here's the tribute. Here's a nod to all these different genres that influenced us as creators, but then we're doing it in doing something new. And I think, just like I said, there's a continuum. Some people are on extreme both ends. Most of us want, I think, are in somewhere in the middle and we want that mix. It's like we get bored easy. We don't just want the same thing. But if something's too out there, you know, it unnerves a lot of people, right? Mm-hmm, it's like, now maybe you're one of those people that are like, yeah, make it as weird as possible. And, you know, that's fine with me. There are definitely people like that. But most people are somewhere where it's like, okay, I want new content. Like I'm bored with this. So, and that can be, you know, I think a good example, and you can see like the mug I'm drinking out of. Nintendo's a company that I think does this really well because they've got these franchises that there's a continuity, there's a through line, right? There's a new Mario game, there's a new Zelda game. But they often do things either through the interface with the way they do the console. Like if you remember the Wii had the motion controls and then like the Switch has got this cool thing where you can play as a handheld or dock it for your TV. But like the new Zelda game that was really, really popular.
It's amazing. It's an amazing game.
Yeah, it's a great game. Like, but it was like, okay, there was this like, this is the Zelda world. But then they had this cool, they borrowed from this, like people like these building mechanics too. Right. And so I think that that's to me like nostalgia done well. It's like people don't just want to they don't just want to play another Zelda game that's exactly like Ocarina of Time. They want something to feel true to that sacred sense of this is why I love this world and like being in this world. But I also want like to do something new and something fresh. And I think that, and it's not, that's not just updated graphics. You see this a lot. Like, I don't know if you play video games, you see this a lot with like, they just make games and they just update the graphics.
Yeah. It's just,
there's a certain level of like, okay, if you really love that game and you want to play it in HD, because it hurts your eyes to play the old version. Great. But a lot of times what makes the game successful is if they do, they change the mechanics, they make it more modern. And that's using progress, right? Like that's obviously like a very narrow entertainment version of progress, but better controls in a video game is progress. There's actually really, really popular, you know, a lot of indie studios are making like 16-bit looking, you know, retro graphic games, which I enjoy a lot. But like they're in a lot of ways, they're a lot more fun to play than the old games because they have like the modern things of like you can save the game. You know, right? I mean, it just those sort of enhancements, and then they put in new elements of it to where it feels like, okay, this is definitely like a, you know, a modern game, but it's got this like cool like pixel style animation. So to me, that's where nostalgia, it's like, can really be innovative. It can really be like fresh, because it's like, yeah, you're doing something like that. And you can obviously see your love, your passion, your nostalgia come through this product. But now you're doing some, you're also, the best way to pay tribute to something nostalgically, in my opinion, is to take it to that next level, right? Is to be like, okay, the torch has been passed to me, you know, in culture, torch has passed to my generation, but we can't just do what they did in the past. We got to keep moving it forward. And I think that's kind of the best. Like I said, I'm not an art critic or a media critic, but like experientially, that's where I feel the most fulfilled with nostalgia is when it does that. But yeah, some people just want to rewatch Friends. You're right.
You know, I think with the John Wick example, I think that's the closest thing we'll get to like the original Matrix with Keanu Reeves and like that. I think people kind of sort of like, I think that's why they can like really, that's not the only reason, but I think it's like the closest thing we'll get to it and people like it. And I mean, that's why I like
it. And they'll probably overdo it, right? It'll probably live past its prime. And
yeah, that's fine. I mean, there's a fifth one in the works and, you know, maybe it'll be good, but I don't know. And I think you're right. The Zelda thing is a great example of that. Because, I mean, it still keeps the kind of like, you know, 8-bit, 16-bit, whatever. But it's the story and it's the open world aspect of it. And it's all the kind of, you know, mechanics of things are so much easier. And there's more things you can do in that world. I mean, when Breath of the Wild came out, I mean, I thought it was probably one of the best games I ever played. I mean, it was amazing. And the new one that's out, I started playing it when it came out, Tears of the Kingdom. And it just like expands on Breath of the Wild. And, you know, every time there's that piece of it, it's like, ooh, can you do the follow-up album? Like, man, that was, you're touching on something real special here. Can you do that? And I remember I played like 15 hours of Tears of the Kingdom. And I had to stop because I was like, I was not being like a responsible adult. Like I was like staying up late. I was like, I couldn't get up in the morning. I was like spending 6 hours on the weekend. I was like, I cannot do this. But it's really good. Yeah. It's really good. The story's captivating. It's a lot of fun. And it doesn't need to have, you know, God of War graphics and play. Right. You know, I mean, God of War's fine, but like, it's just, there's something like, this is super familiar. I mean, I'm also older, so I remember playing on the original Nintendo and Super Nintendo. So it's like, wow, this feels great. But then it's also like, you know, the story and what you can do. And there's just the possibilities feel kind of limitless. And so it's just like, wow, like this is like hitting all the points I want at the same time. And it's like, it's great. Right. Like that's what makes it, I think, why people like it. But so I would agree. That's a great example of like, you know, how it is kind of forward moving. It takes things that work and it keeps building and building, building onto it. And, you know, and I mean, Nintendo's got a great brain trust of people over there, you know, doing stuff.
I mean, they really have it dialed in with that. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I'll say about that is, you know, I think nostalgia also works really well when it has this intergenerational or cultural continuity component. It's like, you can play something and share it with your kids, you know, younger generations, and it be like, okay, this was the thing that got me into this, you know, series, the old school Zelda games. And then it's like, but then they love the new ones. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so there's like it's a common language. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Nostalgia can help create that common language. It's like, yeah, we're going to have differences, generational differences, you know, in terms of like what we're into. But if you find something that hits both, Pixar used to be really good at this. I don't know. Like I've heard that their new movies aren't so great, but I don't know. Like I quit watching them when, so my kids are adults now, but when, you know, we would go watch all these movies, and I remember like they were good at like having like, this is entertaining for an adult. Like there's messages in here, there's themes in here that like pull at adults like heartstrings. Mm-hmm. And really good storytelling. Mm-hmm. But also the kids are laughing and they're excited. And mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So like there definitely are like creators that are very, very good at that, those kind of connection across generational connection points, you know, whether they're nostalgic or not, like they're just, you know, mm-hmm. it's just like, it's good to like, be able to target multiple audiences mm-hmm. and win. I feel like nostalgia, like there is an element of nostalgia that's like that. It's like sharing, like passing down those memories. And then it's exciting. Like this is an extreme example for like the fandom stuff we were talking about, but this was a long time ago, but I went to a young adult. I went to a Star Trek convention mm-hmm. and I like Star Trek, but I wouldn't normally go to a Star Trek convention. I'm not like that diehard. But I won tickets on this. You remember back in the day when people used to listen to radio stations mm-hmm, and you would mm-hmm. call in and request songs and things like that. Mm-hmm. Well, they were doing like a giveaway for tickets and I won tickets. And I went to the Star Trek convention and it was really, one thing that I thought was really cool about it was like, so this is at the time in which, I think like, Deep Space Nine, this was the end of, I think maybe the Next Generation had ended, but this was kind of in that time period. And it was cool because there were like older fans there and they were really into like the old show, the original show and the kind of like old movies and Will, like with Will Shatner as Captain mm-hmm, Kirk, mm-hmm, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then there were like the newer fans were the people that were into the Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of like mixing of like generations and people it legitimately seemed like, cause I was in the younger, you know, the younger group, it generally seemed like the older crowd was very, very excited to see this carry on. Like, oh, there's a new generation of fans. Like this isn't going to die with us. I mean, not to get too existential about it, but this is something that is going to bring people together in future generations. And so that's one of the things that's kind of cool about like those sort of like fandom cultures is like, I was talking to a journalist just the other day. She must have been in her early to mid 20s and she was going on about like she's getting ready to go play Dungeons and Dragons. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I mean, that's old. Like, that's I old. Remember yeah, people old. Playing that like back in, you know, mm-hmm. When I was in, you know, high school and mm-hmm. middle school and stuff like that. So that's kind of an exciting component about like, nostalgia is, you know, which I guess is like independent of like how innovative or creative it is, but just that passing down of culture from generation to generation, that continuity across time, and then seeing what like the younger generations do, see what spin they put on it, and mm-hmm. what direction they take it, mm-hmm. I think is really neat. Mm.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. The intergenerational piece is, I think, somewhat is what kind of keeps a lot of those things alive, which mm-hmm. is, it's interesting. It is interesting to see different generations have different perspectives at different points of a world or whatever creation it is. It's really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the self. So you talk about mm-hmm. Nostalgia as important for self-concept. You talk about, you know, kind of the self-continuity that nostalgia gives. And you also talk about self-esteem. So there's all these different things here. So I guess a few things about this is, you know, how are you kind of defining the self, and how do you see nostalgia as important for the self concept, and then and then about self esteem, which I'm curious about your thoughts there for nostalgia.
Yeah. So some scholars use the term like the self system. I know there is like a philosophical and even, you know, empirical debate about the self, and you know, there are people that even say there is no self and things like that. I'm not sure like how, you know, personally, I don't find that discussion super like useful, a strong term, but it's like whether or not like there obviously isn't like an organ that, you know, there obviously isn't like this is the self, but clearly the human brain and its advanced complexity, you know, has some kind of like self-system in which there's, you know, structures and neurological structures and processes that are heavily involved in, you know, the creation, retrieval, maintenance of autobiographical memories and identities and related, you know, related concepts that allow us to move forward day to day and feel like we're like the same person over time. Mm. And in fact, you know, somebody who is, you know, selfless in the sense of like, if somebody had a dramatic personality change from day to day, or like one day this was their favorite food and another day they hated that food, or, you know, one day they went to their job and they're like, why am I doing this? You know, I mean, that would get to the point of potentially being like pathological, right? We'd say there, you know, there's something very, very disjointed about them. So, you know, wherever people fall in this idea of what the self is, you know, clearly there's something about the human experience that's self-referential, that involves self-consciousness and the ability to organize our goals and preferences and interests in a continuous way that allows us to grow, like to move forward, to be like, you know, I'm training for a marathon today. I'm training for it next week too. I'm going to keep doing this because this is like somehow how I conceptualize myself. So that's really how I see the self, as like the self concept is our answer to the question, who am I? Mm. And it's shaped by personality, shaped of course by life experiences, the memories we experience. It's shaped of course by a lot of things that we don't control. Like we don't control our genetics. We don't control where we grew up and, you know, where we went to school and things like that. And all those like environmental inputs. But then there is also this like what I'd consider like an agentic or creative process of the self, which is, you know, the kind of back and forth between those inputs are, you know, and our own like developing like experimentation and desires of like what we want to do with our lives. So, you know, like an obvious example is when you're a kid, you might say, hey, maybe I'll try playing a musical instrument. Oh, that didn't go so well. Oh, I fell in love with it. Now, you know, I found my passion. Or, I mean, parents often do this. Like we try to encourage our kids to try different things to figure out what it is that like, you know, captures their interest and imagination, figure out where their talents lie. And then ideally like lean into that and try to, you know, try to invest in those things. And so that's like really how I see the self. It's like that who am I and what are my priorities and goals? And of course there's a whole area of moral psychology that gets into, you know, the kind of like the ethics or the morality of the self, of trying to be a good person, and, you know, and or like empathy towards others is partially like determined and by our ability to like imagine how that would feel for us, right? Like that self, again, that self-referential component. So that's a long way of saying, like, I think the self is the sort of complicated system that really involves like our self-consciousness and our awareness of self. Self-esteem is essentially like at a simplest form of self-evaluation. Like, do I see myself as, you know, as being positive or negatively valenced in some domain? Like, people often think of like global or generalized self-esteem, which is just your overall self-evaluation. But then there's a lot of research too on self-esteem can be domain specific too. What I mean by that is you might say, well, in this particular area of life, I think I'm really like, I have a very high evaluation myself, and that's good because that matters a lot to me. It's like very central. So, you know, if you prize yourself in being a good student and you get A's, then you might say like, oh, that boosts my academic self-esteem. You go into the gym and play a game of basketball and you're horrible about it. Maybe that lowers your athletic esteem, but maybe you don't care because you're like that category, that domain's not that central. So a lot of the way our self-esteem is developed, maintained, or threatened, I think relates to this, the extent to which we feel positive or negative about our performance or our abilities in the domains in which we think are key to our central to our self concept. So we can get into the controversies of the self-esteem like stuff if you want, because you know, I think there's some interesting stuff there, but at some basic level, we want to feel good about ourselves, mm-hmm. right? And so the way nostalgia comes into all this is nostalgic, at least personal, you know, what we call personal nostalgia, our own cherished autobiographical memories and our like longing to reconnect with them is often very useful in times in our lives in which we are looking or we're faced with difficult choices and we're not, you know, we feel uncertain about like who we are, what our priorities are. In life, we feel lonely or detached in some way. Life feels meaningless. And we're like, well, who am I? What do I care about? Who do I want to be? Like this concept of my ideal self or my future self. And nostalgic memories, you know, because they're these cherished memories, they can really help us focus on, okay, this is the time in life that I actually, yeah, this, I liked who I was then. Like I, it was really fulfilling and I had these great experiences. Typically they involve relationships. So, you know, a lot of nostalgic memories are about relationships. And when you're in experiences in which you feel like maybe you're chasing things that are materialistic or status oriented, and they're kind of shifting your focus away from these things and you're trying to figure out, well, why am I miserable? These types of memories often like can help put you back on course and be like, oh, like I should spend more time like, you know, thinking about family and friends, because that's actually who I want to be. Like that's, you know, that's actually what brings me meaning and fulfillment. And so nostalgia is very much like can help us like track that self story and remind us of what we care about, and also give us the kind of confidence that we can, you know, I think one of the reasons when we were kind of making jokes about like people want to, you know, they love Star Wars because when they were kids, you know, it was really exciting or whatever. I think a lot of these, those kinds of experiences aren't really even directly about the media content. Like it's a gateway, it's a connection point to like, we're trying to figure out like, you know, we're trying to reconnect with that sense of like energy, like that sense of like freedom or like possibility or like risk, you know, the willingness to take risks or to, you know, it's like when we get older, we kind of suck in these patterns, and it's like we are trying, you know, perhaps ironically, because we're revisiting, you know, like you said, we were just revisiting these old things, but there might be an irony there in that what we're really trying to do is reconnect with that feeling of like, but at that time, this felt new, this felt like, and I think a lot of times that's what nostalgia is also helping us do, is it's helping the self grow. Like we want stability, but we also want to feel like I've become more than I was 20 years ago. And you know, the funny thing being that like sometimes revisiting those memories from 20 years ago can help us reconnect with that like youthful spirit to become more. Like be like, oh yeah, like when I was this age, like, I'm not going to get on a skateboard now, but when I was that age, I remember I did something new and it was risky and it took nerve to do it. Well, maybe that's the kind of nerve I need to rekindle to try a new career path or something like that. And yeah. So I think that's where nostalgia not only can like help us like boost our sense of like self and like our self-esteem, but also can help us like grow, like help the self expand into new spaces, into new directions.
Hmm. Yeah, I like the continuity piece, because that really, you know, I kind of, you know, I view the self as a type of illusion. I don't think there's an actual self. I think we're a conglomeration of different aspects of who we are over time. I do think, though, that there is a continuity of what it means to be us. So I think mm-hmm. nostalgia is probably a important, like, you know, lubricant for that, I think.
Well, and we fear losing. I mean, like, one of our fears is cognitive decline. The idea of, like, losing that sense of self. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. you know mm-hmm. the idea of, like, well, what, you know, not being able to remember loved ones or who you care about, or, you know, mm-hmm. a dramatic personality change. Like that's terrifying at some level because of that continuity piece you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The self-esteem thing I'm curious about, because mm-hmm. we can get into it a little bit, I guess, but my understanding is that self-esteem has a kind of up and down relationship. I think, you know, it's been around for a while, and then there's a lot of good research on it that, you know, kind of shows that, like, you know, it's probably not what we think it is. At best, it's very gray and unclear. And some people say it's, you know, complete bullshit, as, you know, as far as a concept. Mm-hmm. And then there's a kind of like, you know, I think a lot of the times when things, not always, but I think with this one in particular, when things kind of in academia, when there's a lot of research done on it, and then we find that it's, you know, we can't say as conclusively, or there's a lot, there's too much noise, or it's mixed variability, it then kind of leaks out to, like, you know, pop psychology. And then it's like everyone yeah. goes and runs with it. I feel like self-esteem sort of has done that a little bit, but there was a, mm-hmm. there was a good review paper a couple of years ago, which kind of details all this. It's some folks out of Pepperdine. It's Aramo and Levy, I think that's who it is. Where they kind of just track, like, you know, how it started and, you know, the kind of cycle of it. And there's other papers on there as well, out there as well, about, you know, self-esteem just isn't a really good construct to try and talk about how do we love ourselves. So I don't know, mm-hmm. how do you, I mean, you know, we don't have to get super in the weeds of it, but what do you think yeah. about, like, criticisms or claims against the idea of self-esteem being an actual kind of construct?
Yeah. So I think one, you know, you hit some good points. I mean, I think one challenge, especially in, you know, Western culture, I suppose, is the self-esteem concept really got, when you mentioned pop psychology, it really got turned into this, like, enterprise of, well, if we just boost everyone's self, if we just make everyone, like, love themselves, like, affirmate, you know, this kind of affirmation culture, mm-hmm. then that's going to lead to these outcomes. And Will Storer wrote the author Will Storer wrote a really good book on this called Selfie a number of years ago. Mm. He kind of talked about, like, the sort of, even the political history of how, like, the self-esteem movement became something that both on the left and right people liked, because, on, you know, on the, like, progressive side, oh, this is going to, like, lead to all these, like, you know, kind of positive outcomes. If we can just enhance kids' self-esteem, they're going to, you know, they're going to do much better at school and so forth. And on the conservative side, it was like, oh, this is a really, like, affordable intervention. You know, it's not, you know, there's no, it's, it seems like it's not going to cost much. And so, like, you know, why not? But then that turned out to be, at best, like, nothing, at worst, disastrous, in the sense that, like, we promoted a culture in which, you know, people use words like participation trophies. Like, we promoted a culture in which, like, oh, we should just tell people to love themselves, as opposed to what I think a more reasonable analysis of self-esteem is, to the extent that it's anchored, like, to self-evaluation is anchored to reality at some level. Like, it's good to get, like, it's good to feel good about yourself. Like, when, you know, when you're doing well, like the examples I provided, like, if, you know, you want to find out if you actually are a good athlete, and, mm-hmm. and yeah. that can be good to get that kind of information. But yeah, you know, there is, you know, so that's just to say the utility of self-esteem. You know, the main thing I should say that I know about it is, you know, the last I checked, the sort of general consensus was that, low self-esteem is bad. Like, it's a, you know, it's an indicator of, like, depression, right? Like, if you hate yourself, if you think you're a loser, like, that's not going to probably lead to a lot of great outcomes. So it's like very, very low self-esteem is bad. Very, very high undeserved self-esteem we think of as being narcissistic, mm-hmm. right? Like, extreme self-love. But there seems to be something to, like, you know, obviously people valuing themselves and liking themselves, whatever you call that, is motivating, right? Like, to feel like you're a worthy person. And then there's, like, you know, there's all sorts of spinoff literatures. Like, there's the, like, the intrinsic self kind of idea, which is like a self-esteem based on, you know, just a more moral perception that everyone deserves, you know, everyone's a person of worth, like everyone's a person of value, and you should feel that way about yourself. And it doesn't mean you're good in any particular thing, but like you're a human being who deserves to be affirmed in some way. And, you know, I get that, but that's the reason I was like kind of criticizing the Western cultural, the more narcissistic side of it, because it definitely became like, I felt like it became more of a, especially in the education psychology space, it definitely became more of a like, oh, this is going to be a way to like produce all these outcomes of just affirming children. And, you know, it turns out that at least from what I understand, like, that wasn't, not only was that not successful, that, you know, was in many ways, it made people falsely like fragile. And it would have been like one argument, for instance, is it would have been better to focus on like self-regulation or self-control, like actually the things that lead to better. It's like getting the causal area the other direction, right? It's like, it shouldn't be self-esteem comes first and then you'll get good at things. You should get good at things, and then you should feel the reward of like of the fulfillment that comes from achievement. You know, and so like it's like they got it backwards or something. But I mean, I don't know if that's what, you know, that's what you meant by all that. But
no, it's, I mean, I think the new iteration of this is self-compassion, and I think that, like, look, I mean, I'm not again, I'm not the person that needs to be the that is the gatekeeper of what words are used. I just think that there should be an accuracy. I agree. I think that there's maybe either we have words already or terms already, or we don't know quite the extent of it of, yes, we want to feel good about ourselves. If you call that self-esteem, if you call that self-compassion, fine. I think that based on the scientific literature we have, it's just kind of not conclusive about that as an actual construct, right? Where, you know, as distinct from something like, you know, intelligence, right? We know that's a real thing, even though people claim it isn't, right? But we know that's a real thing. We know personality is a real thing. And, you know, even if you know, you can take the best literature on, you know, the Big Five or whatever, you know, that. But you can debate in, you know, how many aspects of conscientiousness are there? And there's like 17 different ways to talk about them, but they're really kind of the same thing. Like, that's fine. And I kind of find self-esteem, again, I'm not close to this literature, but as something like that is, we probably have other things or terms for it. I don't think everything needs a new term and then a whole industry that's selling, you know, those books that like those self-help books that are like, you know, I feel like there's 20 of those books out there and they're all the same book. It's just like, we're kind of repackaged a little differently. And you know, this stuff kind of sells. It's like what people want to hear. Right. You know, and I, at the end of the day, I think your point is right. You know, how do we have a way to kind of think well or positively about ourselves, but based in reality? I think that's, that's definitely an important thing to have. We can get existential here. We can kind of kind of land on this. I love existential thought. There's a couple of years I taught existential theory and therapy for grad students, I really enjoyed doing that. So I'm very sympathetic to existential practice. So we're all gonna die. This is I was actually just saying this week. we're all gonna die. You can't really love or appreciate life unless you have a concept of ending somehow. Otherwise, there's no kind of juxtaposition that gives it a kind of good contrast, which is strange. But it sucks. Like, nobody wants to think about not being here anymore, right? And we hope it's far away in the future. For most of us, but that's still a hard thing to handle. I mean, philosophers have thought about this, clinicians have thought about this. You know, different types of people are thinking about death and dying, abstractly and conceptually. So, how does nostalgia help us with this idea that we're going to die and we have an expiration date? But further to that, how is it not self-denial, or how is it not avoiding the thinking about death or dying obviously you don't want to, you know, ruminate on it and be perseverative on it. But yeah, what's the kind of balance or sweet spot there of how nostalgia can help us to understand or cope with the idea that we'll eventually die?
So that's the question that actually got me interested in nostalgia to begin with. Many years ago, when I was in graduate school, you know, I was interested in existential psychology, in particular the writing of Ernest Becker and the denial of death, and these ideas of what does it mean to be an organism that, as far as we know, is uniquely aware of the inevitability of our mortality, right? So all the things you said, we know we're going to die, and that's not, you know, it's not good news.
Nope.
But, you know, and I kind of went down an interesting path with this, because initially my thinking was kind of what you were saying. Like, I had a very defensive view of nostalgia. And so my basic hypothesis, you know, when I first started doing this research, was being able to mentally time travel means being able to think about the future, which is cool in a lot of ways because that gives us goals and so forth. But it also means we can think about death, which is a major bummer, it can cause a considerable amount of anxiety. Of course, that's not productive. So we have to, in some way, like move forward or suppress it or whatever, you know, take different forms. That was kind of that was Becker's analysis. And his analysis really was we use cultural worldviews as a way to deal with this, like as a way to weave ourselves into a more transcendent story, to be like, well, yeah, I'm going to die, but like, I'm going to live on in the afterlife, or I'm part of something that's bigger than me, something transcendent. And it doesn't totally eliminate the pain and mortality, but, you know, maybe it like reduces the sting enough to where I can like move forward with my life and not live paralyzed by existential anxiety. So what I was thinking was like, okay, we can think about the future and that can make us anxious, but maybe our ability to time travel, also is why we think about the past. Or maybe that anxiety that comes from thinking about the future, like we use our same ability to time travel to solve that problem, like by going backwards. And so my original hypothesis was, when people think about their death, they'll become more nostalgic as a way to like remind themselves, you know, like they've lived a meaningful life, and, you know, they've had all these different experiences there, and that death will kind of undermine that sense of, like, mortality will kind of undermine that sense of meaning, that I'll be like, oh man, like, I'm just, you know, all this, I'm just going to die. And then, like, you know, and that will, so that'll decrease meaning, but then we'll look backwards and be like, oh yeah, but I've had all these experiences, and like, that's made life precious and fulfilling, and that'll kind of make me less anxious. And, you know, that's originally what I was testing, and, you know, we found support for that. But then it was interesting that, so that could, you could imagine that being consistent with a very what I would call defensive view of nostalgia, which is, yeah, it's helpful at reducing anxiety, but really it's avoiding, you know, like, you know, like, I don't know if you use this word or not, but it's kind of like an avoidance. It's like, it's making it to where it's distracting me from death. You know, I can think about the past, which is distracting me from my fear of the future. And, but that was what I originally thought. And maybe there's some value to that. You know, maybe, you know, sometimes avoidance can be good. Like, it's not good to sit around and ruminate about death. If I can think about all these great memories and that makes me happy, and then I just move forward, you know, there are some benefits to that. But then, you know, really many years later, collecting lots of nostalgic narratives where we had people share memories with us, and doing other types of experimental studies where we induced nostalgia, where we induced like anxiety, where we did these types of things, I started to change my view, where nostalgia isn't just a defense. It isn't just an avoidance of our existential fears. It's a negotiation with them. And oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes a constructive one, which is, I think it, you know, so for example, if you, you know, a lot of older adults, their nostalgic memories, they will say things like, looking back at this, you know, thinking about my daughter's wedding or the birth of my grandchild or whatever, it gives me hope for the future. Like it has this like inspirational quality. They're not avoiding their like future mortality. They're like expanding their horizon, their picture of it. They're like, oh, there's the next generation will carry on the things that I care about, which I don't think is just a, you could say that's defensive, but there's also something that seems like expansive and about it. It makes people more like generative. It makes them want to, because when I think of defensive, I think of retraction. Like people like, mm-hmm. it's comforting, but you're pulling away. But it seems like really a lot of times nostalgia like pushes people out. Like it's like, oh, I want to do more for my community. I do want to do more for my family. I want to do something that leaves the world better than I found it. And so that's where I think that's where my view started to change of nostalgia is not just a psychological defense that helps reduce negative affect or anxiety, but it's also like an inspiring or growth oriented sort of resource that helps us, you know, recognize that we're part of something, you know, that was here before us and will be, you know, ideally be here beyond us. And that why we're here, like we can be thankful and that we got this chance and we got the shot to be here at all. And we can make, you know, we can do what we can to make a little bit of a positive difference in the world. And that's where I see like the more like existential, like the positive, like existential, you know, like positive psychology. There's like an existential psychology that's very like, you know, more like defensive sort of psychology. That's where I like kind of, I shifted more toward the positive psychology of nostalgia when I started to see how people were really using nostalgia and how it was actually making them hopeful and grateful and making them think beyond themselves.
Mm. Yeah. It sounds like you're touching on a lot of themes there about the idea of this existential agency, right? Mm-hmm. How we can have this mm-hmm. meaningful life with sense of urgency. The thing that I've said a few times before is, you know, I'm not so much when I've thought about this, right? I think about dying all the time, which sounds very terrible.
You need to watch more Friends and Star Wars.
I need to watch more Friends. Yeah.
You will want to die.
I actually hate Friends. I hate Friends. I know that's blasphemous. You know what it is? It's the laugh track for me. I can't get over that. It's just so.
I just never got into like the sitcom, like really most.
Me neither.
Of
me
those
neither.
Things.
Oh. Yeah, no, I'm more of the like Sopranos, The Wire kind of. Mm. You know, when we hit that form of TV, that's where I was all in.
Yeah, same. I prefer that.
But yeah, I think about death in the abstract a lot, and you know. I mean, I love living very much and I love experiencing so many things. And there's a point where that's not going to happen and I will be forgotten and no one will remember me in a lot of ways. And no one will remember all the things I did and how I spent this time. And that doesn't make me depressed. It doesn't make me nervous. It just makes me more... I have more urgency and I have more appreciation for everything that I'm doing because I never mm-hmm. really know when it's the last time. And right. All that said, when I thought about, am I afraid of dying? Is that what it is? I certainly don't want to die, but it's more of time. Like I don't have... Yeah. You know, what is it that I'm not going to be able to do? Why the fear of death, I guess? And it's like, well, no, it's really, I just want more experiences.
Right.
And I don't want to not have the time or the energy or the ability, even when I'm, you know, let's say ostensibly I'll be alive, but I'm, you know, 75 years old and I'm not going to be able to do many things anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, then that's different. You know, life looks different in some ways, but it's that piece of time. I don't feel mm-hmm. I have enough time, which is really what it is. And so it's an interesting thing of like, well, how do you, I mean, I know what I do for myself, but generally, how does nostalgia help us live a life of a type of urgency? Not like I got to hurry up and finish this, but this urgency of things are precious and time is short and life is very fragile in some ways. And it is a gift. How does nostalgia help us with this existential agency?
I remember during the pandemic, this became, especially I would say the early part of the pandemic when we really didn't know like how deadly is this? How contagious is it? Mm-hmm. Should we be like washing our groceries?
Yeah.
I mean, remember all of the things and like, and I think there really was a sense of like, we just don't know. And so it was very anxiety provoking, especially in the context of, you know, one big finding in psychology is that when people are like awaiting electric shock, for instance, or like when people are going through something that causes fear or anxiety, they like to be around other people. And so there's something weird about a pandemic, which the thing that would be comforting in an anxiety provoking time is the thing that's anxiety provoking, which is other people, right? Because they might give you COVID. And so I remember that time being a really, really good example of nostalgia, in which people had this sense of like, not just like, oh, am I going to get COVID and die? I don't mean that so much. I mean, some people thought that, but I mean, this sense of like, has the world like, am I ever going to be able to have the time I had before, like the freedom to be able to do things, like how, mm-hmm. you know, has the world really changed in a dramatic mm-hmm. way? You know, people were rewatching the movie Contagion. You know, it's like, is society going to be totally different after this? Like, is this going to be like the Black Death or something? And you know, that was, you know, the reason I'm bringing up that example is because it did have this like time element of like, what people became very nostalgic in the period of time, you know, probably for a lot of reasons. One, they were stuck at home and they had more time to be nostalgic. Mm-hmm. But even, you know, like Spotify documented that the streaming of nostalgic music like dramatically increased during the pandemic, even controlling for the fact that just streaming music in general increased during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But especially nostalgic music. And, you know, people really, really revisiting memories. And my wife and I were doing this very explicitly. We were talking about, oh, you know, wow, why were we too like busy or lazy to go to that concert? Like, we really should have done that. We should have taken advantage of, because time is precious, mm-hmm. right? It's this like concept of like, and now we can't go do those things. When the pandemic is over, we're going to prioritize getting out, going out to dinner, going out to breweries, hanging out with friends, doing stuff. And so I think, you know, all that's to say is I think one of the things that nostalgia helps us do when we have these like time related, like fears, it's like, have I lost the time to do that? Has too, you know, like, can I not do that anymore? Or is my time limited? Or like, you know, these nostalgic memories will often remind us of like what was precious about that. And at its best can really help us like prioritize that. Like, oh, if we get out of this situation, you know, I should spend since time is limited, I should spend more of it like with loved ones. Like, I shouldn't be so worried about all this other nonsense. And so I think when we're dealing with that, like that recognition that we only have so much time, our nostalgic memories help us decide what to focus on and what to privilege. And people did things, you know, they moved closer to family, they changed jobs, they, you know, we're also creatures of habit. So a lot of people just went, you know, things just went back to the way they were. But I do think there was plenty of examples of people using their nostalgia to be like, well, I don't want to take time for granted after this. Mm. And I want to like do things. I mean, travel's been way up post pandemic. People are like, oh, like all the things that, you know, I thought, I'll get around to that someday.
As have the prices have gone up as well.
Right, so right.
People have caught on to this.
So I think, you know, it helps us like that recognition that time is limited. Like, it's like, okay, well, how do I want to spend it then? Mm. And nostalgic memories can help, you know, enlighten us into that. Like, okay, well, what did I like doing? What are the things that have been the most meaningful to me? And not that I want to necessarily repeat those things exactly, but there's elements of those things that might help me figure out how to, you know, how to prioritize my time going forward.
Mm. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that that's where, you know, a lot of the times these things can be, you know, helpful reminders. So, you know, how do we have, finally, when people, you know, read your book or they think about nostalgia, how can we have a healthy relationship individually and collectively with nostalgia? You know, I was kind of the, you know, grumpy old person earlier talking about people, you know, being nostalgic and all these things, right? You know, I'm not against nostalgia by any means. I do it all the time. And yeah. I think there's, as you talk about in the book and you talked about here, there's some really great aspects of it. So like for me, how do we find the balance? How do we find the balance right. as individual people, but also as in our groups, in, you know, in our society, how do we have a healthy connection to nostalgia?
Yeah. I think the key is, you know, and I've been doing nostalgia research and advising and discussions, you know, around nostalgia for, you know, over two decades. And to me, really what I've, so a lot of this is informed by the science, but also just like the experience of like these interactions, working with organizations, talking to people like yourself, you know, just getting inputs from all sorts of different types of people who have positive and negative views of nostalgia, have totally different cultural experiences with nostalgia, personal experiences with nostalgia. And, you know, kind of what I've come around to is we all do it and get benefits from it, or most of us do, like somewhat naturally, like it's sort of ingrained in us to be nostalgic. It's like when we're facing a problem, our brains want solutions and our memories, you know, our cherished memories can like help us, can provide clues to, you know, like, okay, like figure out what to do, whether even if it's just as simple as comforting us or not so like, you know, anxious, calming us down, so then we can direct our attention to like solving the problem, or more directly actually providing some useful information for solving that problem. But that, so I think at some level we just do it naturally. But what I think is, you know, we also exercise naturally. We walk around, but we also know like you can really enhance your exercise if you learn how to, if you get a fitness coach or trainer, or like learn how to do proper form when you go to the gym and things like that. Mm. And so like that, I think nostalgia, like exercise, I think nostalgia, if we use it more intentionally and surgically, and that can help us learn to avoid some of the pitfalls that you were talking about of like overuse, or, you know, doing something that's, you know, just it's nostalgia, but it's not in a way that's pushing us forward. It can help us avoid that. So as, you know, as a concrete example, you know, and this is one that I come up against a lot. It's like people will talk about nostalgia at the like kind of broader cultural level, and they'll be like, you know, nostalgia can be a real barrier to progress in the sense of if people just are like, oh, the past was better. And then, you know, it's like, well, you know, the world is changing, and, you know, then you might think it was better, but you're biased, and better for whom and under what circumstances. And so what I try to think of is when I say intentional is like, if you find yourself making a generalized, like having a generalized attitude, like, oh, everything sucks now and the past was better, it's worth stopping yourself and digging deeper and be like, why do I think that? What specifically about the past is better? Because it turns out, like, if you ask people, would you know, if you start asking people more targeted questions, their attitude about the past being better changes pretty quickly. If you said, you think the 1950s were better? Okay, would you, if your child was diagnosed with cancer, would you rather have the medicine available at the time, or would you rather have today's you know, medical advances? I don't think that part was better. You know, do you think, would you rather raise a daughter then, or would you rather raise a daughter now? Like, do you think that, you know, rights for women were, you know, so if you start going down these like list of questions, and what you'll find is like a lot of that sentiment becomes, you know, directed towards, oh no, there is something about like, we sit around together as a family and ate dinner and now everyone's staring at their phones, or like, there are things that they, that are rising to the surface for them because these are the things that they're displeased with today that tend to make them more have a generalized nostalgia. But being more surgical, more intentional, I think, can be like, okay, well, how can you use the specific things you dislike about right now to not make it, you know, oh, everything was better, I don't want to give up progress. How can you use that to be like, well, what's a challenge you're facing today that you think there's wisdom from the past? And like, people will do this, like they'll be like, oh, I want to spend more time, and I spend too much time in front of a screen, which, you know, I'm guilty of this as well. It's like, and they have this sense of like, oh, when I was a kid, or I remember my grandma would tell me stories about like riding a horse to school, and, you know, how they just had free reign of the farm and all of this stuff. It's like, okay, well, you're not going to go back to that. But there is something that you can pull from that. Like, well, yeah, we could all benefit from spending more time in nature, and those nostalgic memories can help you, can kind of help you get there. So that's where I think that if you find yourself being nostalgic in a way that's too generalized, too global, I think it's worth like really engaging in some intentional thinking about it. And what really are you dissatisfied with? We've actually done some surveys on this. Like for example, even young people, you might find this interesting. Even young people who grew up as digital natives express, you know, pretty high amounts, very similar actually, older generations of nostalgia for a time before everyone was plugged in to on like social media and stuff. They're not saying, I want to give up technology, right? Yeah. They're not saying like, I wish I didn't have so many like TV options, or, you know, I wish my video game graphics were crappier. Like, they're not saying that stuff. They're saying there's something about the way our generation is using technology right now that maybe is unhealthy. We don't want to give up the innovation. We want to interact with it no more. We want to find a healthier way. And there's something about the past where people were talking to each other and they weren't distracted by their phones. Maybe there's a lesson to learn from that. So I think that's where we can use nostalgia more as a like surgically, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that that's important, because a lot of the times people want to make it this kind of black and white thing, and
right,
you know, it's got to be an all or nothing. And I don't think anybody's really saying that. I think that there's a way of which, obviously, there's an individualized perspective of how, you know, where people are at with this. But I think that, yeah, I think that we need to incorporate a lot of different elements and to say, okay, like, you know, how do we use this in ways that are for some people really good. And maybe, you know, some people it's like, okay, you know, you can't, don't live too much back in the past. So I think it really depends on, you know, where people are at.
Use the what I say is like, pull the past to the present. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't go backwards. Like,
yeah,
pull from the past. Keep moving forward and like find the threads that you think are useful, mm-hmm. As you know, as kind of a way of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Well, Clay, this was so much fun. I greatly appreciate it. Again, the book is Pass Forward: How Nostalgia Can Help You Live a More Meaningful Life. Everyone should go pick it up. Big thanks, man, for coming on. This was such a fun conversation. I really loved it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having the conversation, and I appreciate your insights as well.
Absolutely.